My compliments go to the poster maker. I think that was very well done. All right. Outdated halacha indeed. What they call a no-brainer. This subject divides into two categories. The first one could be dealt with very quickly, but I'm going to expand it just for the sake of some interesting points, and then we'll go to the really difficult part. First part is the Oraisa, those laws that come from God through Moses. Now, to talk about laws coming from God that are outdated is to get your theology upside down. We're talking about laws coming from the creator of the universe. Laws coming from the one who created, creates, and runs the universe. That he made the laws and he's running the universe, to talk about them being outdated is just out of the question. After all, many laws have trigger conditions. Under conditions A to B. And for that reason, when conditions change, you can't always do all the laws. Like sacrifices. There's no temple. According to most, you can't do sacrifices. If the majority of Jews don't live in the land of Israel, the agricultural laws don't apply, according to most. So, there's plenty of room for God, if he wants, to engineer that certain laws should be done or should not be done. If the law is on the books, and the conditions still apply, and the creator of the universe is running the world, then to talk about them being outdated is just dumb. In addition to the logic of the situation, which for me as a logician is really the most important thing. But I want to show you something which, if you're not aware of it, it's worth knowing. Take a look in your blue book on page 817. Starting with verse 37, you have the Parsha of Tzitzis. Familiar to most of you, because you read it twice a day. Now look at verse 38. Just verse 38. And tell me, intuitively, what's out of order. What phrase belongs on the just verse 38 on page 817. Just that one verse. Something in that verse is out of order. Where would you put turquoise wool instead of where it is? To say it's out of order means you should have a better place to put it. Rewrite. Somebody rewrite. Okay, you saw it before. Rewrite the verse and put something someplace elsewhere and make better, should make better sense.
I'm not sure if I'm right, but maybe throughout the generations, speak to the children of Israel and say to them throughout their generations, they shall make themselves stitches on the corner of their garments.
Why? Why would you look what he's doing? He's moving throughout the generations to the beginning of the sentence, basically, or close to the beginning of the sentence. If I ask you for another alternative, what could you have done instead of that? You're right. I think you're right. Let's just see how well you understand it. Could you have done it another way?
Is that same phrase?
Mm-hmm.
I would have done it the way I told you, but maybe I really wanted to stretch it, to speak to the children of Israel and say to them that they shall make themselves stitches throughout their generations on the corner of their garments.
Okay, but he's got the right idea. What's wrong here? The phrase throughout the generations is splitting up. It's splitting up two mitzvos. made tzitzis and the kunst of the garments throughout the generations. Period. And they shall place upon the tzitzis of each corner a thread of turquoise wool. He says, why should you split them up with the phrase throughout their generations? Let throughout their generations apply to the whole thing. Now, do you see the answer?
Yeah, because it's implying that and they shall place them upon the tzitzis of each, that doesn't apply throughout their generations.
Look what the Torah is telling you here.
It's
we prophesied. Lost the blue wool.
It's prophesied.
We lost the trails. We lost the trails. So Moshe Rabbeinu, writing the Torah, maybe 1,500 years before we lost the trails, Kadosh Baruch Hu wrote in the Torah, tzitzis forever. But trails, no. That won't be throughout the generations. Parsha Tzitzis already has in it a provision what will happen when you lose the treilis. Was it 1,500 years later? If you want a clue as to how the Torah works, when Kadosh Baruch Hu writes the mitzvah, here's the clue as to how it works. Of course it takes into account the whole future. Kadosh Baruch Hu is not limited. He knows the future. And he controls the future. So of course, the idea of an outdated deraisa is inconceivable. Furthermore, I just saw in the Sefer Shalom of the Sfarim Rebbe, his first essay on Parshas Truma. He brings the Medrash Tanchuma. He's wondering why we have 4 weeks dedicated to the Mishkan. 4 weeks dedicated to the Mishkan. Why is it so important? And it's only what happened once upon a time. What would be so central about having 4 weeks dedicated to the Mishkan? So he brought a Medrash Tanchuma. This Medrash Tanchuma reads as follows. In the book of Yechezkel, Ezekiel, God tells Ezekiel this, the description, the structure, the size, the shape of how the Beis HaMikdash should be built. So the Medrash says, Ezekiel says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we're sitting in Babylonia. We're in exile. We can't build anything. Why are you telling me to teach how to build the Beis HaMikdash? Bring us back to Eretz Yisrael. When we come back to Eretz Yisrael, then teach us what we're supposed to do by building the Beis HaMikdash. What good is it to have that information here in Babylonia? So Kadosh Baruch Hu said to Yechezkel, you're making a mistake. The building of the Beis HaMikdash cannot be delayed. It's a mitzvah that has to be carried out at all times. Building the Beis HaMikdash has to be carried out at all times. So teach them how to build it in Babylonia. What's the answer? They're still in Babylonia. They're still in Babylonia. They still can't build it. The answer is learning the parshios, how to build it, is building. The learning of the building is also building. Just as Chazal say in the Gemara, anybody who occupies himself, who studies the parsha of Ola, the paragraph in the Torah that teaches how to bring a korban Ola, an Ola sacrifice, it's as if he offered an Ola sacrifice, even though he didn't physically bring an animal to the temple because the temple is destroyed. Studying the Parsha of Ola is as if he had brought an Ola sacrifice. So, this Medrash is telling you, studying the laws of building the temple is carrying out building the temple as much as you can when you can't do it physically. So, Hashem said to Yechezkel, you're in Babylonia, and the Jewish people are in Babylonia, and they can't construct anything, but they could study it. And if they study it, they're doing what they can to perform the mitzvah. And it counts to them as performing the mitzvah under these conditions where you can't do it physically. So when we read these parshios, and we study and analyze how the Mishkan was built, how it was constructed and what it meant. We are carrying out the mitzvah of building a place for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to rest his presence in this world, even though we can't carry it out physically under these conditions. So it means that every mitzvah applies at all times. Only different mitzvahs apply in different ways. Every mitzvah is divided into three sections, three elements. There's an element of thought, an element of speech, and an element of physical performance. All three are important. All three are essential. Now, under certain conditions, you can carry out one or the other. Sometimes you can't carry out the action, but you can carry out the thought and the speech. That also is participating in the mitzvah, realizing the mitzvah, and fulfilling the mitzvah on the levels that it is given to you to fulfill it. So studying these parshas, reading them in shul and paying attention, and reading the translation, and reading the commentaries, and analyzing them physically, and then analyzing them socially, and then analyzing in spiritual terms, metaphysical terms, all of it is performing the mitzvah on the level that you're able to perform it, and it counts even in our times when we cannot carry it out physically. So the Torah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wrote is a Torah for all generations, and every part of it applies all the time. Only it applies in different ways and different levels. None of it can be out of date. It's absurd to even think in those terms. Are you with me so far? That's your ISIS. That's as far as the mitzvahs that come straight from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. To talk about being out of date is just foolishness.
So is God's speech a physical what?
Behavior. Physical action. They're called physical action. The question really arises with respect to rabbinic laws. Rabbinic laws. The rabbis make a law, and they make a law for a reason. For reasons. Let's suppose the rabbis make a law for a reason, and after a period of time, the reason no longer applies. Here's where you could have what they call in the Gemara Havamina, at least a thought. The rabbis are not omniscient. They can't know the whole future. They said that this law is to accomplish a certain purpose, and now the purpose isn't being accomplished. So that law, we would say, is really out of date. And then the implication is, if it's really out of date, then there's no reason to keep it anymore. There's a lot wrong here. There's a lot wrong here. Let me start with some simple observations. So here's the thought. A law was made for a reason. The reason doesn't apply. So the law is out of date. So it doesn't apply anymore. And we should stop following the law. Would you use that reasoning in any other legal system? A secular legal system with no religious ideas, no religious components, a purely pragmatic system, a human system, a rational system, a logical system, a pragmatic system, would you say a law made for a certain reason, when the reason no longer applies, the law doesn't have to be followed because the reason doesn't apply anymore? No one would say that in any legal system at all. Never would you have such an idea. Here's an example. 1973, there was a war in this part of the world. The Arabs attacked Israel on Yom Kippur. And Israel fought back. As a result of it, there was an oil embargo. The Arab countries stopped delivering oil to the West. And there was an oil shortage. And the United States put into law a 55 mile an hour speed limit on all the interstate roads, because the engine runs very efficiently at 55 miles per hour, and above that it burns much extra oil. Now, let's imagine, this isn't what really happened, but let's imagine, you had the 55 mile an hour speed limit. Why was it put in? Because the Arabs had an oil embargo. I remember, there was gas rationing. You could only buy gas on alternate days on the basis of the last number of your license plate. Odd numbers on Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. Even numbers on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. I remember lines, waiting half an hour in line to get gas. Now let's imagine that the Arabs release their embargo in May. In June, the oil starts arriving in the United States. By July, it's already refined and at the pumps. Prices go down. Supplies go up. In August, there's plenty of gas for everybody. Now, let's imagine a person who buys gas in August, gets out of the highway, and he says, 55 miles an hour? Why? Because there's not enough gas? There's plenty of gas. The whole rule was invented because there wasn't enough gas. There's plenty of gas. I'm doing 70. Is he going to get a ticket?
Yeah.
You bet. He's definitely going to get a ticket. And when he comes before the judge, and he says, but Your Honor, it's obvious why they put it in. They put in the law because of the gas. And now there's plenty of gas. What do you want from me? What will the judge tell him?
It's still a law.
It's still a law. The Congress didn't change it. And until the Congress changes it, it's a law. There's nothing you can do about it. I know what you're going to do. I'll get there. Give me 120 seconds and I'll get there. Right? This isn't the first time I've been through this. No, and besides, where are the congressmen in August?
They're on vacation.
They're in Hawaii and they're in Alaska and they're visiting China to see the Great Wall. They're not there. Wait till October till they come back. As long as the legislature has not changed the law, the law is still in practice and it's still valid and a person will still be punished for breaking it. No, the legislature has to reconsider it. And you know what happened, by the way? When the oil embargo was taken off, they left the law in place. For 20 years, they left it in place. You know why? Because it's also safer. It also saves lives. Only saving lives wasn't enough to move people to put it in place. Once it was in place, they left it there. And here you learn something very important. When you make a law for one reason, it doesn't mean that that's the only reason. There might have been another reason that you had at first which wasn't strong enough. Or you might discover new reasons. You might discover, once it's put in place, that it has other benefits. And that's why the legislature has to decide whether to take it off. Because it's not obvious. If the original reason doesn't apply, that there aren't other reasons to keep it. And another thing, the whole of society runs on being able to predict what people will do. You need to have stability. You need to have organization. And you need to have the ability to know how things are going to work in the future. If you have $1 million to invest, and you invest it in a business, it could take 3 years for you to see a profit. How do you know that 3 years from now you'll be able to make a profit? Only because you can predict how things will be 3 years from now. If laws change willy-nilly, you can't tell. Suppose you're putting money into transportation by shipping. Trucking. If the speed limits change, you may not be able to make a profit. You may not be able to get the goods there on time. Then the investment goes down the drain. So there's a general rule. Don't change a law until you have to. Unless you have to. Otherwise, people don't know how the future is going to work and they can't make long-term plans. Often profits depend upon long-term plans. So the legislature puts a law in place for a reason. The reason doesn't apply. You always wait for the legislature to come back and reconsider and analyze whether the law should be changed or not. You don't just assume that because the reason doesn't apply, the law shouldn't apply. Similarly, it's 3 a.m. and we are in a residential area and the streets are absolutely deserted. And here's George driving his car and he comes to a stop sign. And he says, let's think, boys and girls, what is the reason for a stop sign? Isn't it to protect life? Isn't it to protect property? Isn't it to prevent accidents? There's nobody on the street but me. Okay, his English is poor. Should have said I. Right. Surely the stop sign doesn't mean 3 a.m. That's not what it means. That's not the purpose of it. The purpose of it is at 9 a.m. when the place is filled with cars and filled with pedestrians. That's when you need a stop sign. At 3 a.m. you don't need a stop sign. So he sails through the stop sign. Will he get a ticket? You bet. He'll definitely get a ticket. Why? Isn't he right? Isn't he right that the stop sign is there because it's designed to protect lives and property? And at 3 a.m., he tells you don't need it for that. Sorry, say again? They don't need you to stop.
You just stop at the stop sign and have this whole thing instead of anyone.
Will he get a ticket? Yes. Why? Why will he get a ticket? Because if at 3 a.m. you can decide that's not the purpose, what about at 6:10? Sun's just coming over the hill. The last mist is clearing away. There are two other cars that are in the distance. Now, is it really needed at 6:10? No, come on, I can see them, they can see me, they're far enough away, there's not really any chance here. What about 6:25, you know? The first school child is on his way to school, but there's only one kid in the whole street. Am I going to hit him? Is he going to hit me? No, obviously not. Surely, you know, suppose I stop a little bit, you know, not the whole way. That's enough, isn't it? I mean, after, I can see it. I have very good reflexes. I'm only 26, you know, and I've been doing this for... You'll end up with anarchy. Everybody will be making his own decision when to keep the law, when not to keep the law, and you end up with anarchy. You can't run a country like that. You can't run a society like that. So, even in secular law, even in pragmatic countries, you don't say, well, the reason no longer applies, the law no longer applies, and everybody can do as he pleases. We don't say that. Ah, but you will object. This is a question of waiting from August till October until our legislators get back from Hawaii. Here, we're waiting about 1,500 years. That's a long time to wait. Surely, the critic will say, after 300 years, 400 years of a law that's outdated, that the reason doesn't apply, surely by that time, we ought to be able to take action and let it go. Who's we? I mean, whoever, the people as a whole. Yes, usually you wait for the legislature, but we don't have a legislature. It's been 1,500 years since we've had a Sanhedrin. A little more, 1,650 years since we've had a Sanhedrin. We don't have the legislature. The legislature's not coming back in a hurry. So, isn't there a kind of statute of limitations after which people can get together and decide that since the reason doesn't apply, and they'll have to make the judgment that other reasons don't apply, and it's not a question of stability. But imagine people getting together and analyzing. That reason, the original reason doesn't apply. New reasons haven't come up. And we'll only do one every 10 years, so it won't be destabilizing. And it'll be okay to revise it. The answer to that is this. Now, really, now we're going back to the first theme. How come we don't have a Sanhedrin? What happened? So, you'll tell me, it was the Roman persecutions. The Romans made giving smicha, ordination, from one to another, a capital crime, and they killed people for it, and eventually smicha died out. So, why don't we have a Sanhedrin? It's the Romans! Roman persecution! Should we let Roman persecution stop the development of Judaism? Stop the development of Torah? Isn't that giving victory to the enemy? That meaningless, nonsensical political battle. You know, giving, blaming the victim and giving victory to the enemy and all that kind of nonsense. Right? What's the answer? The answer is that if we don't have a Sanhedrin, it's not because of the Romans. It's because of Kodesh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to have a Sanhedrin. History is not Hefker. Hefker means without rules, without control, accidental, random. History is not accidental. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is running the world. Now, the same God who said, when the Sanhedrin passes a law, you need another Sanhedrin to annul it or change it. That same God who gave us that law is the guy who's running history. So, if God said, this law the Sanhedrin passed, to change it, need another Sanhedrin. And he said, I'm taking away your Sanhedrin. What's the conclusion? I don't want you to change it. He's sending you two messages, and he's hoping that you're as good as the average eight-year-old school child. If I tell you you need X, and I'm taking away X, then I don't want you to do it. So it's a very clear message from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that those laws were passed by Sanhedrin, and where the Torah says you need another Sanhedrin to change them. If we don't have a Sanhedrin, it means the HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not want us to change it. So, outdated, again, won't even get off the ground. The same God who told us the one, told us, organized the other, so that we won't be able to change it. And we're getting the message that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who runs history, doesn't want these laws changed. Questions up to here. There's a couple of hands up there. Shout it down.
What do you do about the rabbinical ordination to cover your drink if you leave it?
I'll come to it. Yeah.
Can you discuss that before your last point? It's not that the rabbis don't create the law to change it. It would seem that they do, but only when they're more stringent. You can discuss, Gershon and maybe medicine.
I don't know what more stringent means. The rabbis created rules which told us not to perform biblical laws. Now, is that more stringent than your...
Not to perform them.
Would that be more stringent than in your definition?
In practice, I would say yes.
When they tell us not to perform the biblical law. So what will be more lenient? Take, for example, Rosh Hashanah that comes out on Shabbos. The Torah says blow shofar. The rabbis say don't blow shofar. Is that more strict, more lenient? What is that?
That's more
problematic. I see. Okay.
The example you gave is more problematic.
But let's say, I wouldn't say, to say they're more strict as a category, as a general rule, needs a definition of strictness. But what's
in a general sense.
Let's take the ones that are more strict, whichever ones they are. So, again, what's your question?
Perhaps you can discuss marriage as something therapeutic. I know, obviously, if it's perfect methods, we have built-in leniency, but in general, the notion that somehow, because we might speculate that there is a secondary reason, does this have to do with us staying further away from Sinai, so we can't set the undermines in mind?
You know of cases where we speculate as a secondary reason? I don't know what you're referring to.
You gave in your introduction, your prologue, the fact that there are often other reasons that are either discovered subsequently,
right.
Or then we might speculate that they were actually contemplated by the legislative force in passing the law.
Right.
So we're left with having to speculate, and as regards medicine, for example, we have other notions where we might think that the rabbi said something of the mind. Now that we're no longer grinding medicine on Shabbat and mortar.
Oh, that's what you... I'm thinking of medicine, the practice of medicine. I don't want to be... I had some more. Okay. That's the same as this square. I'm going to come to these two examples in a moment. Yeah.
Do you have an understanding of why I should
have
away the...
I can only tell you a general idea. The things that we lost... The things that we lost are items that gave us power. The temple gave us power, gave us the power to do various mitzvot. Having majority in the land of Israel gave us the power to organize the country in a certain way. Having a king gave us certain powers. Having a Sanhedrin gave us certain powers. When you take away power, what you're saying is your use of the power was not constructive, but destructive. And therefore, I cannot trust you to use it anymore. Like taking matches away from children. That's the general idea. Had we been using the powers correctly, Kadroch would not have taken them away. So, now which particular powers they are, and exactly how we use them destructively, I can't go into that much detail. But that's the general idea. Yeah.
Two more questions. First of all, is the Sanhedrin really applicable here, because a lot of what we follow to the letter of the law was written, correct me if I'm wrong, and was codified after the Sanhedrin, you know, at the time of the Sanhedrin. So we had the codification of the law was put into place much later. So the laws are the same, but the interpretations into how we can practice them, you know, were certainly put into place afterwards. So the question is, with your example of the laws, like the speed limit and things like that, the question isn't whether we should follow it. The question is whether we should change it, whether we should do something different.
Look, if you have two questions here. If you have a law, somebody has to interpret it in practice and tell you what to do. That, in a legal system, let's say like the United States, that's usually the function of the judicial branch. They're the ones that decide who violated and who didn't violate, how it applies in practice. Interpretation goes on, and interpretation can be changed, interpretation can be challenged and overruled, because the interpretation didn't come from the Sanhedrin. So we're not talking about interpretation now. But these are all interpretations of laws that go back to the Sanhedrin. Now, I'm considering someone who challenges the law, not the interpretation. Challenge the interpretation. Let's see your scholarship. Go ahead and figure out what was wrong with the original interpretation and make an argument. That can always be done. That can always be done. There's no limit on that. For that, you don't need another Sanhedrin, because the first interpretation wasn't made by Sanhedrin either.
What I'm saying is, granted, they're based on original laws, but the extension of those can be considered in terms of their application today in subsequent generations could be considered law, so to speak, in terms of...
So I'm telling you, if it isn't an explicit decree of the Sanhedrin, where the Sanhedrin considered the thing and voted and gave out a formulation, if it isn't like that, but rather a later generation interpreted the law and said, yeah, it applies here, it doesn't apply there, that can always be challenged. Except when the Gemara says Hilchos, but other than that, you can always be challenged, and indeed is challenged, and you have debates going down to the present day. I'm talking where they challenge it at the source. Okay, so, yeah.
I was just going to say, what about when they say it's outdated or changed because of, like, Machlokes is in the Gemara, so therefore, there are just differing opinions between two different things, so that might have been established prior, of course, so there wouldn't be these arguments.
I don't know what a difference of opinion has to do with being outdated. Even at the time, it means it was controversial.
It's not reliable. It's more, a lot of information.
Oh, well, that's another matter. Okay, I can't go into this detail. I'm going to continue where I was. Okay, but I'll just say this. If you have a difference of opinion about a subject, you should not say, oh, well, they disagree as to whether it's A or B, so obviously they've lost all the information, so we're free to choose C, D, E, F, G, H, I, and J. That is not logical, and you wouldn't do it anywhere else in life. A person has a medical condition, and the medical community is divided between one therapy or another. That doesn't mean that it should use voodoo dolls or macrobiotic diet. You don't take a difference of opinion to mean that we have no information on the subject whatsoever. What you do is you say, if there's a difference of opinion, I don't know for sure what's right, but it's overwhelmingly likely that one of the two opinions is right, and I'll do my best to follow one of them, if I can follow both, combining them even better, and if not, I'll follow one of them, and know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu trusts, can see that I tried to do the best that I can. Now, what's really surprising, given what I've told you, is that there are certain Jewish laws which, when the times change, aren't put into practice anymore. Just because the times change. Just because the original reason doesn't apply anymore. Now the shoe's on the other foot. If you follow the logic so far, the shoe's on the other foot. Now we should say nothing should ever change. The old way we started was wrong. Why shouldn't we do differently? What do you mean? No one will ever do differently. And yet there are some that do. Now here's the example of one that does and one that doesn't. Between the two of you, these are the examples that you raised. The Gemara says that an unattended liquid, an open, unattended liquid, glass of water, leave a glass of water in a room, go to the other room, have a telephone conversation, come back. You're not allowed to drink the water. Not allowed to drink the water. Mayim megulim. Why? Because in those days they had snakes and scorpions in their habitations. And while you're out in the other room, a snake or a scorpion could have come to drink the water and left behind traces of its poison, and it could be dangerous for you to drink the water. So the Gemara says, don't drink the water. That's one rule. Another rule, not to take medicine on Shabbos if your life's not in danger or a limb is not in danger, just for pain. And even there are variations of pain. I'm not going into the halacha, that in detail. But in general, for non-serious conditions, you don't take medicine on Shabbos. Why not? Because medicines were stored in ancient times as solids. When you needed to take the medicine, you ground the solid into a powder, and then you took it as a powder. So if you decided to take medicine at a particular time, it meant you ground it then. So if you're going to take medicine on Shabbos afternoon for a headache, then you could easily come to grind the solid into the powder and take it for the headache. Grinding on Shabbos is a malacha. It's a biblical prohibition. So the rabbi says, don't take medicines in non-serious conditions because you might come to grind. Now in both cases, the reason doesn't apply anymore. Nobody grinds in order to make medicines today. Maybe Searle does, you know, somewhere in Iowa, you know, when they make this stuff in the factory. When it comes to me in a package of pills, nobody in his home grinds in order to make medicine. Now you're on Tuesdays, let alone on Shabbos. And we don't have snakes and scorpions in our habitations. So the reasons for both laws have lapsed. The reasons no longer apply. So in terms of saying out of date, they're both out of date. Nevertheless, the Shulchan Aruch splits here. The Shulchan Aruch splits here. With respect to the water, the uncovered water, the Shulchan Aruch says you can drink the water. Even though the Talmudic rule is you should not drink the water, the Shulchan Aruch says you can drink the water. We change what we do. On the other hand, according to many, there's some discussion about this, but according to many, taking medicines on Shabbos is just as awesome today as it used to be. So both of them have reasons, and both reasons no longer apply. How come, one, what we do changed, and the other, what we do didn't change? Now, I don't know if you noticed about the words I'm speaking, but I'm choosing them very carefully. I said, what we do changed. I didn't say the law changed. I said, what we do changed. And that's the truth. And here's the difference. The difference is the way the law is made. What does the law say? In the case of the medicines, the law says don't take medicines on Shabbos for non-serious cases. That's the law. Imagine a book of laws. 4,000 laws in a giant book. Now, in the back of the book, there are footnotes. Historical footnotes. Would you like to know under what conditions they made this law? We're telling you it's a piece of historical interest. It's just a footnote in the back of the book. By the way, the law about taking medicines was made when people used to grind salads into powders. But the law is, don't take medicines. No, nobody grinds. So what? The law is there. The law stays there. Nothing changes. And you still can't take medicines. But when you come to uncovered water, the law says the following. Don't take unnecessary risks. That's the law. The law says nothing about water. The law says don't take unnecessary risks. That's a general rule. Then the Talmud says, listen, we have snakes and scorpions in our houses. We know that they could drink from uncovered liquids. So we are telling you that drinking uncovered liquids is an unnecessary risk. The law says nothing about liquids. The law says don't take unnecessary risks. Only the rabbis and the Talmud tell you, under our conditions, uncovered liquids are an unnecessary risk. What happens 1,000 years later when there are no snakes and scorpions in the houses? It's not risky anymore. If it's not risky, then the law still applies. The law still is real. The law still is valid. Nothing in the law has changed. Don't take unnecessary risks. That's the law. But that was not an unnecessary risk. So the law doesn't apply to this case anymore. It doesn't apply to this action anymore. So by writing the law that way, the Talmud is telling us that when the conditions change, our practice can change because the law won't apply anymore. That's the difference. In the case of the medicines, the law was don't take medicine. And that law stays. In the case of the water, the law is don't take unnecessary risk. And that law stays. It stays. Nothing changes. Only, it isn't risky anymore. And if it isn't risky anymore, then of course, there's no reason not to do it. One more point, and then I'll take your questions. This might be what you're thinking this time. I don't know for sure. No, you're sure not. Okay. There's only one problem. When you look in the Talmud at each law, it's not always clear which kind of law it is. The law doesn't wave a flag and say, I'm meant to be understood this way or that way. You have to figure out, on the basis of the way the Talmud discusses the law, what objections are raised and what answers are given and what applications are made. You have to figure out whether it's a law like the medicine law or whether it's a law like the water law. Like the risk law. You have to figure it out. And there could be differences of opinion. And if you will hear that certain groups are lenient with respect to medicine, as there are, one of the reasons is that they suspect that the medicine law was written more like the water law. In other words, they suspect it was written like this. Don't risk grinding on Shabbos. Don't do anything that could bring you to grind on Shabbos. Be careful about grinding on Shabbos. Suppose the law is written that way. What conclusion would I draw about medicine? In our times, I would say medicine is perfectly permissible. Because nobody grinds anymore. If the law says, be careful about grinding, when I take medicine, I'm not sloppy about grinding. I'm not risking grinding because nobody grinds anymore. So it all depends upon what the law says. Does the law say don't take medicine? Or does the law say be careful about grinding? For those who will ever look it up and for the tapes, if you look in the Stipler, in the Kedilus Yaakov, on Masechta Tanis, or Space, you'll see this whole analysis is brought there. Now you have a question. 2 for 2. Yeah.
If not for the grinding, there won't be the which one of the three
Let's say it is that, but so I'm not following the point. So therefore, what?
So why else would the make their law?
Let's say that's the only reason.
So what's the reason away? That's
good. So now we'll go back to the whole thing. The legislature has to reconsider it and pass on it. We don't have the legislature because the Kodesh Baruch Hu took it away. The whole argument comes marching back in, doesn't it?
How do we answer these things? I take it this is an internal approach. But how do we approach it from the external side? Say our Jewish friends that are on the fringes of observance, and if they say that times have changed and therefore we should change with it, how do we answer?
Look, this is a matter of general strategy. Sometimes the best you can do for someone to say, listen, I'm operating according to certain assumptions. Can you see that given my assumptions, my conclusions are correct? If he's not prejudiced, he ought to be able to see that. Then you could say, can you show me that my assumptions are wrong? Can you prove my assumptions are wrong? That there is a God, that God gave the Torah at Sinai, that these rules are written into the Torah, you can't prove that it's wrong? So then, I think my position is as good as yours. Seeing as how internally my logic is correct, and you can't disprove my assumptions. So it's very interesting. in the Siman of Mayim Achronim, the first Seif says Mayim Achronim Chova. It's an absolute obligation. That's because in the Gemara there's a whole discussion whether it is a Chova or it isn't. And at the end of the same Siman it says, since we don't have Melach Stomis, Sodomite salt anymore, which was dangerous to the eyes and other parts of the body, therefore in our times you don't have to do it anymore. You look at the Mishnah Berurah says it's a good idea to do it all anyway. Men in general have taken on as a custom. This is the reason why most women don't do it. Most women don't do it because, formally speaking, it's not obligated to do it. Otherwise, there's no difference between men and women. If the salt is dangerous, you're not supposed to take that chance. Men and women would be equal. Men have taken on as a custom. The Gaon says you have to do it. He says there are Kabbalistic reasons as well. And here's a good example. They did it because they said the public reason was salt from Sodom. But he says the real reason, not the real reason, but an underlying reason that they didn't mention is a certain Kabbalistic idea, and that still applies. But it's not fine. Even though the Mishnah Berurah recommends that you do it, it's really not fine. Yes?
Can you touch on some of the hints in the text of the law? Like, how can you tell what's really the law, or if it's just a statement that's not no longer, was never a law?
See if I can remember what the stifler says over there.
Did you re-quote
the... It's the Gilos Yaakov is written as essays on different Masechtas. Gilos Yaakov. And on Tanis, he has only two essays, and it's the second essay. But how the hints go? I don't remember them. I don't know if I could classify them in any useful way. Yeah. Usually the Mishnah Berurah will be explicit. Usually he will say, and when the reason doesn't apply, and so on and so on. No, I think you'd have to wait for him to say it, because he's writing a book about how to live. It's all practical. And if he doesn't tell you when the reason doesn't apply that you're allowed to do it, then I wouldn't assume that. Otherwise, he would have told you. Yeah.
Is there any way, like, that we can reinstate the Sanhedrin without Eliyahu Navi? I heard the Chazon Ish was once given, they asked him if all Kol Yisrael could agree upon, like, a anointing of Sanhedrin, that they would have the powers of a Sanhedrin, and they'd be able to paskin for all of Kol Yisrael one way.
This was tried once. In the times of the Beis Yosef, of Yosef Karo, in Sfas, according to one commentator on the Rambam, it comes out that if all the Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael would agree on one person, they could give him smicha. And then, of course, once one person has smicha, he can give it to as many others as he wants. So, if I remember correctly, at the time they decided they would give it to the Beis Yosef, to Yosef Karo, and they wanted to set up more smicha, possibly leading to a Sanhedrin, but the Rabbanim in Yerushalayim didn't agree, and that killed it. And since then, since it's a very minority opinion, no one has mentioned doing such a thing.
Could we pull it off with, like, the Lali Hashem, if we get that good on with...
So I'm saying, it's one opinion in how to understand the Rambam, and that's all. And therefore, it doesn't seem to be very practical.
First of all, when you put the case about uncovered borders, excuse me, I'm talking to you, firstly, don't I understand that any law that's in the Talmud, when we understand the law is discussed in the Talmud, and the Talmud comes to a conclusion based on the reading. So my second part is, how come you can't say that, for instance, the uncovered water is not also like the going to the other thing? If these Kabbalistic reasons involved also, why shouldn't drink uncovered water? I mean, according to what I once heard, I think that the point that you can't drink uncovered water also because you may be shaving on inside or stuff like that, so that it was in the Kabbalah.
Let me go back to the reasoning, because I don't see how what you're saying connects with the reasoning. Let's imagine we know the law is stated as follows: don't take unnecessary risks. That's the law. Don't take unnecessary risks.
whenever the Talmud goes into the Shikyo, they explain an example of one that's serving.
Right. But now, conditions have changed. So I'm looking at the same law. I pledge allegiance to the law. The law says don't take unnecessary risks. It doesn't tell me not to do this anymore.
It's unnecessary risk. It's unnecessarily a risk for a different reason that the Talmud doesn't say.
But then you have to have somebody to teach you what it is. In other words, we're not now talking about a reason for a law. Because the law is don't take unnecessary risks. No one's speculating on the reason for that law. The reason for that law is obvious. Protect your life. What we're talking about now is the application of the law. Does this thing constitute an unnecessary risk or not? So here's not reasons. We're not trying to make up reasons. We're trying to figure out the facts. Is this risky or isn't it risky? If somebody happens to know some other reason that it's risky, he will say that law applies to it. Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo was a Mekubal also, and he writes that that there's no reason not to drink it. And the Gaon disagrees. People are free to disagree. There's nothing surprising in that. But what they disagree about now is, does this reality come under that law? This has nothing to do with reasons for laws.
Is there anything you see anywhere, any worship or any state where there's something to commemorate your water that you prepare for Dagobaster the night before, when you prepare it, to put something on top of it, so it's covered?
Okay, I don't know. I now we've really jumped to halacha and minhagim and so on and so on. I know that there are different practices, but what they are and where they come from is beyond my. I don't know. I don't know.
Legitimate?
I don't know. We don't. But whether other people do and what reasons they would have, I don't know. Custom and law, not my field. I told you that. Philosophy is my field. Are you with me? Yeah.
I like the alternate reason why not to repeal a law when it's binding. You say that to repeal a law because of social change, sociological differences, that is all hurt that all the time, and it's dangerous to go by what's current, what's modern, just because there's a chance that, electricity will blow out in the world and we'll be left with having some objects by hand, et cetera, et cetera. Is that a valid concern?
I don't know. You do find such ideas, but I don't know how you find them from hundreds of years ago. I don't know whether they really would be used today for the same thing. It's Yom Tov Sheni they talk about and signaling back and forth. Now, I don't know. I don't know how seriously to take it. In other words, take Yom Tov Sheni. I don't know if you know how this was done. When the court declared a new moon in Yerushalayim, and they had to get the information to Babylonia, the first thing they did was they had fires on hilltops. And there was a series of hilltops from here to Babylonia, and within a couple of hours, Babylonia knew. They lit fires, and the fires went out. Okay, so it was raining that night. The next night they could light them. Within a day or two, the Babylonia knew, and there was no problem. Then some of our friends who wanted to falsify the Torah and mess things up lit phony fires. So then nobody knew. Is it the right fire or the wrong fire? It became very complicated. That's when they started sending out messengers. But it took a long time for the messengers to arrive. There are some places where the messengers didn't get. And that's why you have 2 days of holidays, because there are places where the messengers didn't get in time, and they didn't know when the month was started. Then we fixed the calendar. No longer was the court deciding when the Rosh Chodesh will be, when the month will start. You have a fixed calendar, 17 years from now, when the thing is going to start. No, so why should you keep 2 days? We know exactly when the month is starting. So, there's the Gemara in Bay about this, and there are about six different ways to understand the Gemara. And one way of understanding it is maybe the court will be reestablished and maybe we'll be deciding again and we will have to inform the rest of the world as to the decision, and we could run into the same problem that some places won't be reached. And since we run into that problem, we will need 2 days of Yom Tov, So we're leaving it in the same condition as it was. Now, what about today, where it's very hard to imagine if the Sanhedrin will be reestablished and reestablish the months, we'll determine the months. It's very hard to imagine that you won't be able to get reliable information to everywhere in the world in a matter of 2 or 3 days. Even if you can't use communications because spies are going to mess up the communications, you can always send people. Send them by plane, send them by helicopters, you know, you can always get people there. So, is it really that worry? Is it that worry that is keeping us from establishing one day Yom Tov for everywhere? One of the Rishonim over there in that Gemara says that the Sanhedrin voted on this and they passed a law. The words in the Gemara, Minig Avasein Biyadenu, our custom of our ancestors is in our hands, and we're bound by it, was not a statement of the Talmud about practice. It's recording a decision of the Sanhedrin. Then we're back in the same category that we were talking about before. Sanhedrin said, yes, keep it. Why? Footnote at the back of the book, because maybe things will change again. But the law is keep it. Nope, keep it is keep it. Right, so if you take that position, you're talking about the doubt, that's worried that will it go back and will it not go back and do we have electricity in airplanes? Don't we have electricity in airplanes? That's all put on the back of the book. So I don't know how seriously to take that worry as the thing that makes the halacha work. Second time around. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier today about the difference between Tom and Rashi and the differences between them. How do we work out differences where something is mentioned? I don't know how many other examples it happens in, but I guess it happens with Tom. That it's mentioned in black and white in the Torah, but then the rabbis discuss.
Okay. This is very, very important. And I know it's 9:30, and that's above and beyond, but I'll tell you a time and a half. We're going over time. This is very important. Here's a general category. With this, I'll close. I'm going to take a few minutes to do this right. Let's take something which is a halacha that goes back to Moses. And it's been done by everybody, every day. For 100 years, 500 years, 1,000 years, 1,500 years. How could there possibly be a difference of opinion about a halacha like that? What? How to build tefillin? Open them up and take a look. How could there possibly be a difference of opinion? How to build tefillin? It's unbelievable. You have 1,000 years of practice. When could such a doubt ever arise? Now, I want you to know, if you ever go to university and you study the history of Jewish law, this is where your professor will tell you, you see, Philip really can't go back to Moses. It's impossible. Because there's a difference of opinion as to how to make Philip. Obviously, before that difference of opinion, there was no settled practice. So whenever that difference of opinion came in, which wasn't Rashi and Benatam, it goes back to the Gemara, maybe even further back, wherever it is, that must have been the origin of tefillin. It couldn't be before that. Now, this is just rank ignorance. Listen carefully. There are ways in which something could be done for 1,000 years, and then someone could say, I think the whole past 1,000 years is wrong, we should change it. It is possible to do that. Even though we know the way Moses did it, and King David did it, and King Solomon did it, and Ezra did it, and Nehemiah did it, Rabbi Akiva could come along and say, no, Moses was wrong, and Rabbi Akiva was, Moses did he interpret. Let's leave Moses out for the moment. But King David was wrong, and Solomon was wrong, and Ezra was wrong, and Nehemiah was wrong. All of them were wrong. We should change it all. I know two such rules. There are probably more. One rule is where the halacha is based on interpreting a pasuk in the Torah. If you're interpreting a verse in the Torah, we do this because these words are written here, those words are written there, this is what this means, that what that means, put it together, and this is the right way to do it. If the Sanhedrin in Moses' time decided that you should do this because this word is here, and that word is there, and this word means this, and that word means that, put them together and come out with this conclusion, if it's an analysis that they made, any later Sanhedrin can overturn it. Doesn't have to be bigger, doesn't have to be wiser, any later Sanhedrin can overturn it. So, you could come to a time, 1,000 years later, and say, yes, this is how King David wore his tzitzis, and this is how Solomon wore his tzitzis, and Ezra and Nehemiah. But we today think they're all wrong. All of them, they're wrong. They're wrong. They have the right to do that. That's one way. The other way, in Rav Tesler, the fourth volume of Mr. Milio, says something. It's only one page, less than a page. It's a little cryptic, but this is what he says. Every law has a formulation, a verbal formulation. If ABC, then do XYZ. The exact words of the formulation are the law. Let's suppose that everybody knows what to do because everybody's doing it. I've been doing it for hundreds of years. But let's suppose that they lose the exact law. We know what to do. Let's say it's tzitzis, you know. Wind them this way. Everybody's tzitzis around the same way. And you teach the children wind it this way. And everybody learns the same thing. But you lose the exact words of the law. Then, says Rav Tesler, it's not a law anymore. It's only a custom. It's demoted to a custom, to a minute. And then any other legal sources you have can be used to challenge the minute and overturn it. So in other words, I know that 200 years ago it used to be a law. I know that it was a law to do it this way. I just don't know what the words are. So the answer is yes, 200 years ago it used to be a law, and today it's not a law anymore. And since it's not a law anymore, if you have any other legal source that you could use against it, you're allowed to overturn it. And he uses this for tefillin. He says explicitly, this is the reason why there are different forms of tefillin. Because the way you build the tefillin is all Torah Shabbat Peh. It's all oral. The written Torah tells you nothing about how to build tefillin at all. It's all oral. And at a certain point in time, they lost the real formulation. They knew which tefillin, which parshas, which paragraphs to put in which order. Because everybody's tefillin were the same, but they lost the words. When they lost the words, it became only custom. And then if you had any other legal source that would be relevant, you could use it to overturn. And that's when the difference of opinions came into being. So, the fact that everybody did it the same for 1,000 years still leaves open the possibility that after 1,000 years, you could turn around and say, not anymore. We have reason to challenge the practice. Even though we know it was a law, it's no longer a law, and we can challenge it. Don't let anybody tell you that if a matter is controversial, it couldn't have existed beforehand. It could have existed for 1,000 years and become controversial after 1,000 years.
But what does that do to the reward? Let's say if you're following the minhag, before it was demoted according to the law, and you just don't know it, how does that affect the reward that you're getting and the people that do it otherwise?
So the general rule is this. Any mitzvah that a Jew decided to do and was prevented from doing against his will, he gets reward for. He has a guy over there and he wants to talk. On the other side of the street, I say, okay, when the traffic clears, I'm going across, I'm going to give him a shekel. Or, oh, sorry, inflation, 5 shekels. And now the buses go by, and after 45 seconds, the buses go by, and he's gone. So when the light turns green, I go across and I look for him, and he's gone. No, I get credit for giving him the struggle. Because I decided to do it, and I was prevented by something that was against my will, against my ability to change. Now over here, you have a difference of opinion, and I'm doing my best to try to do the right thing. It's not my fault that there's a difference of opinion. I can't help it, and I definitely get credit for doing it right. No, what's that got to do? He's talking about where I don't know the truth. So let me tell you what the Mishnah Berurah says. When you have a Yom Tov on Friday, and then comes Shabbos, so it's you're really not supposed to work on Yom Tov for the sake of Shabbos. Each day is holy. But if you make a special kind of Eruv, you're allowed to cook, let's say, on Yom Tov for Shabbos. Eruv Tov Shiva. Everybody should make his own Eruv. But if a person forgets, he can rely on the Rav of the town. The Rav, when he makes his Eruv, says that I have in mind, everybody that's out. That's if you forget and you're what's called a shogeg. It's an accident, right? The Mishnah Berurah says you could claim accident once. If you ever forget again, you're a posheya. Posheya means a premeditated criminal. What do you mean? You forgot a second time? You forgot once already and you know that you could forget. Then you should have taken precautions not to forget. So, maybe it could work once, you know, but more than once, I don't think you're going to get away with it. Okay.